Okay, so we are in the ninth. I'm sorry, we are not in the ninth chapter at all. We are in the eighth chapter of Revelation, beginning in verse 10, and last week we finished verse 9. So we began last week with the trumpets, the seven trumpets of the tribulation, and the seven trumpets I mentioned are really an extension of the seven seals that are opened. So at the opening of the seventh seal, we then enter into the seventh trumpet. And then we also have the introduction here. We'll see this today, an introduction of these things called the woes. And then after we get through the seven trumpets, we'll have the seven bowls. And that's going to bring us right through the end of the book of Revelation. Now, I mentioned last week that Revelation, these trumpets are a relatively short portion of the book. A lot of people talk about how, you know, the book of Revelation is all about the seals and the trumpets and the bowls. And I mean, to an extent that's true because they control the chronology of the book, but they're not really the central focus of the book, nor do they take up most of the space. What we're going to see once we get after chapter 9, we're going to start seeing a lot of material that is descriptive of the world at the time of the revelation. We're going to see an extended treatment of the woman and the dragon in chapter 12. We'll see extended discussions of descriptions of warfare, a long treatment of the destruction of the whore Babylon, mystery Babylon. We'll talk about whether those are one or two things later. So there's a lot of material coming forwards in the future that is gonna change. So right now it's almost as though John's in a hurrying pace. Now last week, Deanne, I think you brought it up, Deanne. But last week we talked about focus on the earth. And it's funny because I didn't see anything last week, but then this week as I was reading some of the material on these trumpets, they were talking about the focus of the trumpets being on attacking the earth. And kind of, it was interesting, people were saying a lot of the same things that we had been saying in our study. So it seems like that was a pretty good observation and a pretty solid one. And so tonight we're going to look at verses 10 through 13. If we get through that really quickly and everybody's ready to go on, we can probably jump into chapter 9, maybe a couple verses in chapter 9. So I will kind of just leave it up to us, and we can go at whatever pace we want, and then we will get going. So I'm reading out of my translation, and we starting in verse 10 of chapter 8, we read, "And the third angel trumpeted, and out of the heaven a great burning star like a torch fell, and it fell upon the third of the rivers and upon the springs of the waters, and the name of the star is said the Wormwood. And the third of the waters became into wormwood, and many of the men died out of the waters that were embittered. And the fourth angel trumpeted, and the third of the sun and the third of the moon and the third of the stars were plagued, so that the third of them was darkened, and the day should not shine the third of it, and the night likewise. And I saw, and I heard one eagle flying in mid-heaven, saying in a great voice, Woe, 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 to the ones dwelling upon the earth out of the remaining plagues of the trumpets of the angels of the about to come trumpeting." Okay, so once again, just a reminder, this is deliberately bad English because it's supposed to be good Greek. I want you guys, as you read my translation, to notice John's style, and the only way to do that in English is to give you a really bad English translation. But, you know, it's like they said about the American Standard Version of 1901. They asked some scholar, they said, "What do you think about it?" And he said, "It's good Greek and terrible English," you know? So that's what I'm trying to give you, is good Greek and bad English, because you guys all have good translations. You can refer to lots of good English translations that are out there. I mean, I can without hesitation. There are, golly, you've got so many really reliable and excellent modern English translations, as well as, you know, kind of your heirloom translations, your King James Version, New King James, even the older RSV. You know, you got a lot of reliable translations. So refer to those, but this is to help us focus on what John is saying in Greek that doesn't transfer over. So Like last week, we're looking at trumpeting. We're looking at two trumpets. And we mentioned last week as well that when we look at this material, you notice that there is a similar pattern to what we saw in the seals, right? So when you look at the seals, there's the opening of the seals, and then there's kind of this interruption, and then the continuation of the seals, and then we have kind of an interlude type material. Well, here we have the first four seals are opened, and then there's this statement in verse 13, this very odd statement about the eagle flying in midair saying, "Woe," to those who are coming. And we're going to see these woes are going to be repeated throughout the rest of the book, or throughout a portion of the book of Revelation, I should say. So with that in mind, kind of just thinking about that, like where we've been, where we're going, what the material is, what are some things that we notice that stand out to us right away before diving deeply into any of the verses? What stands out to you? Yeah. Okay, so wormwood. Yeah, no, so we did not talk about this last week. And when we talk about wormwood, does anybody know what wormwood is? Okay, all right, Deanne looked it up. What do you got? Yeah, great material in that. So wormwood, like we just said, is a plant, and it's called Artemisia. So you guys have probably seen, if you've been to a garden store, you've probably seen Artemisia. There are a lot of different forms of Artemisia. It comes from the word Artemis, which was one of the Greek goddesses of their pantheon. But there's a form of Artemisia which is poisonous. And it has to be extremely high doses. I think from what I read, there's only been one known case of somebody who died from an overdose of it. But throughout history, it's been used, and even today, they use it in some different kinds of medicine. And it's the Greek word for that Artemisia wormwood is absinthos, or absinthion. And you guys ever heard of absinthe, the liquor absinthe? So absinthe is this green liquor, and it was very famous in Europe back in the days of Van Gogh. Like Van Gogh and the Belle Époque is what they called it in France, the beautiful epic, or the beautiful epoch, the beautiful time period. And so absinthe became this very famous drink, and it was known to have hallucinogenic properties. And people, they talked about seeing the green fairy when you drank absinthe. It's illegal in the United States. Well, part of the flavoring comes from this wormwood material. So wormwood, and there are other things like different kinds of vermouth liquors use absinthe, or not use absinthe, they use wormwood, or the Greek name is absinthion, or absinthos. And so even some foods and medicines, they talk about having medicinal properties, but it's extremely bitter. It's extremely bitter. And so it was known in the ancient world as something that was kind of a curative, but they also knew that it could have some negative effects if you took too much of it. And so we have that, and it's interesting you bring up Chernobyl. Definitely make sure we talk about that later, but just to answer your question, we have this word absinthion. It's referring to the plant Artemisia, the toxic version of, medicinal toxic version. And what's interesting is there are, and this is just for you guys, maybe nobody cares, but the Old Testament talks about wormwood. Now, obviously, the Hebrew word is different, but in different versions of the Greek Old Testament, which is called the Septuagint, it was a translation done by Greek scholars who wanted to translate the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek because so many Hebrews were speaking Aramaic. They couldn't speak Hebrew anymore. So many Jews and Israelites living in the land, and a lot of them that weren't living in the land, they were living in Alexandria, Egypt, they were living in different places, they couldn't speak Hebrew. They spoke Aramaic or they spoke Greek, but they didn't know Hebrew. And so there was a translation done called the Septuagint, and there are lots of different versions out there. So some of the versions of the Septuagint use this word in the Old Testament. Some of them don't. So there are a couple places, and they're actually really interesting places. But wormwood is used often in the Bible, and it's interesting because wormwood is also used for judgment in the Bible. So would somebody please turn to Jeremiah chapter 9, and Jeremiah 9, and look at verses. Let's look at verses 14 and 15 specifically. This is a hymnal. This is not going to help me. I don't know. I grabbed the hymnal. It's not going to get me there. So. So if we go to Jeremiah chapter 9, and if I can find it. There we go. Okay. So Jeremiah chapter 9 is talking about judgment over Israel and judgment for their disobedience, for their sins. Beginning in verse 13, the Lord replies, "This has happened because my people have abandoned the instructions I gave them. They have refused to obey my law. Instead, they have stubbornly followed their own desires and worshipped the images of Baal as their ancestors taught them. So now, listen to what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Look, I will feed them with bitterness," that's wormwood right there, "and give them poison to drink. I will scatter them around the world, and they will be strangers in distant lands. Their enemies will chase them with the sword until I have destroyed them completely." Now turn forward to Jeremiah chapter 23, and also in verse 15 specifically. Jeremiah 23, verse 15. We see something similar. We see the judgment of false prophets. And so we read, "Therefore, this is what the Lord Almighty says concerning the prophets. I will feed them with bitterness and give them poison to drink." So, okay, so Jeremiah is repeating himself. Now, we see this several times. Jeremiah repeats himself in the book. Yeah, King James legit actually just says wormwood. That's And the King James uses wormwood, I think, 7 or 8 times, if I remember right. And it says, it's because of Jerusalem's prophets that wickedness fills the land. This is my warning to the people. Do not listen to these prophets when they prophesy to you, filling you with futile hopes. They are making up everything they say. Okay, so there's one other place specifically in the Old Testament that uses this word, and that's in Proverbs chapter 5, verse 4. Proverbs 5, verse 4. Now, like I said, it does matter what version you're using, but the idea of wormwood, of this incredibly bitter, this bitter plant, was well known and it's well carried. But chapter 5 of Proverbs, famous about the story of the avoiding the immoral women, and we see the lips of an immoral woman are as sweet as honey, and her mouth is smoother than oil, but the result is as bitter as poison or wormwood. Sharp as a double-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lead straight to the grave, for she does not care about the path to life. She staggers down a crooked trail and doesn't even realize where it leads. So over and over and over again in the Old Testament, with very few exceptions, when we talk about something bitter, it's almost always in the context of judgment. That's we see throughout the Bible when they talk about the wine of judgment, that people are going to have to drink it down to the dregs, and we talk about the bitterness. There we have that material. So that's a good cover for wormwood. We will come back to this when we go through our verse by verse. But that's a good overview of the biblical theology of wormwood. It's only used here in the New Testament, only in this verse. So it's one of these things where John is kind of on his own here a little bit. Like I said, it's debatable whether this word actually was used in the Old Testament. Some versions of the Septuagint use this word. Some versions use a different word for like a bitter plant. So this could be John just coming up with something with a word that was new. Again, the wormwood plant was well known. They're referring to the same thing, but this actual word may be different. Yes, go ahead. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's it. Absinthos. Absinthos or absinthion? Absinthe? A-B-S? S. S is in Sierra. Y, Yankee. N, Nevada. T, Tango. H, Hotel. E, Echo. It is the Air Force code. So we got that. What else do we see? What are the things that stand out to us right away as we look at this material? Yeah, woe, woe, woe to those dwelling on the earth. Why does that stand out to you, do you think? Where else do we hear woes? And I think your take on it is exactly right. It's this warning. It's a beware. It's something is coming. And like you said, it is anticipatory because he says, you know, woe to you because this is what's about to happen. So I think that's absolutely the right take. Where else do we see woes? What does that remind you guys of? Never three of them in a string together. You're right. But where do we see a lot of woes clustered together in the Bible? What's that? Yeah, Matthew 23, right? Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Woe. I think there are seven woes there, right? I think there are seven condemnations of the Pharisees. Deanne's nodding her head. She's like, yes, Luke, there are seven. Okay, she knows that. She knows it. But yeah, so there are all these woes that are there. And so remember, John, like I know I said that the absinthos, the word for wormwood, is could be a new thing, but John isn't doing a whole lot new, right? So when we see this word woe used, and it's in Greek, it's this very powerful onomatopoeic word, which is ooh-why, and it kind of sounds like owie, you know. So the Hebrew word is similar, and so the idea is it's you're supposed to feel this word, but again, it's drawing us back to previous uses of woe in the Bible, which, like you said, is a warning. You know, what does Jesus say? Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. And he's warning people, stay away from the scribes and the Pharisees. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you load heavy burdens upon the people and you will not lift a finger to lift them yourselves. Woe to you, you whitewash the sepulchres of the prophets, and you say, if we had been alive in our father's time, we would not have killed the prophets. And so you testify against yourselves that it was your fathers who killed the prophets. Fill up then to the measure your father's guilt. And so Jesus is laying woe upon them, but he's also telling people, beware of them. And I think you're 100% right to bring up the woe as a warning, because who's being warned here? The people of the earth. Repentance is still available. When Jesus gives his woes, he's condemning the Pharisees, but he's also telling everybody else, repent. Don't be in league with them. Don't be their partners in this. And so we see these woes, and God is still ready to bring people into forgiveness. He's still ready to receive people into the kingdom. Anything else we see that really stands out to us in this material that we want to talk about before? Yeah, okay, so that is an excellent question. So he's ready to receive people who are willing, who want to be forgiven, but they have to be people who haven't received the mark. You know, no. You're right to bring that up, because that's a really fair point. It would appear, if we take Revelation most literally, that no one who receives the mark of the beast will be saved. Is there any chance for people to repent after that? I don't know. Well, they're going to have to be people who survive from... The 144,000, I believe, survived the entire tribulation. Everyone who's left alive in Israel will be saved. I think that's how Paul's statement, and that in all Israel will be saved, I think that's how it's fulfilled. Because everyone who is alive, who is an Israelite at the end of the tribulation, will be a believer, because nobody's alive who isn't a believer, right? But I think after the Antichrist reveals who he is, I think then we are going to see a lot of people who, this is just my opinion, and you could bring some Bible to me and show me, and because I could be wrong about this, but my feeling is there are a lot of people who accept Antichrist at first, who then later, when he blasphemes at the temple, when he claims to be God, they reject him then at that point. And so I think that you're going to see... my belief is, and I know Dr. Hitchcock talks about it in the book, other people talk about it, when Antichrist is in the temple, there's a rebuilt temple in Jerusalem, and there is a miracle that's done. He calls down fire from heaven, but he proclaims himself to be God, and that's in keeping with what we read in Daniel chapter 7. And so when he proclaims himself to be God, that's when the conflict starts, because when he does that, the Jews are like, okay, wait, no, like... Some of them are ready to accept him. Some of them are ready to accept him as, okay, yeah, you're the Messiah. And others of them, it's kind of second verse, same as the first kind of thing, where it's like, whoa, you can't claim to be God. And so this tension starts, and there's rebellion against him, and he opens up this war against the nation of Israel, which we see. You know, we can finagle with that. There are different opinions, and that doesn't mean I'm right. I could very well be wrong, but that's kind of my gut feeling, is that there is a later rebellion against Antichrist. Yeah, so that's a really good point, and that's actually something that I pointed out. I don't know if you guys saw it, but I got an article published in an academic blog by Faith Life, the company that makes logos, and they published my article, and that was one of the things I pointed out, was the dwellers on earth versus the people who are tenting in heaven. You can't just say the dwellers on earth are just the sinners, because Some of these plagues affect everybody who's on the earth, including the 144,000 and the great multitude who survive. Like, when a third of the day doesn't shine, like, okay, like the light is blotted out for a third of the day. That affects unbelievers too, just as when we look in the Old Testament plagues, what happens in the plagues of Egypt. Some of them affected the Israelites. Some of them didn't, right? So sometimes the Israelites were affected by the plague, sometimes they weren't. Again, it's important to remember these trumpets are in many ways mirroring what we see in the plagues in Egypt. They're supposed to remind us of what was happening there. Any other thoughts before we get into the kind of our verse-by-verse study? All right, let's hop in. So, and the third angel trumpeted, and out of heaven a great burning star, like a torch, fell, and it fell upon the third of the rivers and upon the springs of the waters. Now, there are people who want to try to figure out what this is, and people say, "Oh man, what could this be? Stars don't fall from heaven. Stars are giant balls of gas." Well, now we're not sure that they're giant balls of gas, but whatever. So some people think that they're giant fusion engines, nuclear fusion. So nobody really knows what a star is because nobody's been to one, and at least nobody's been to one and come back. So we don't really know what they are, but this term, again, this burning star like a torch fell, it is pretty well accepted among people who are, like me, people who try to take the Bible as literally as possible. This is a comet or a meteor, right? This is something that falls. We know that there have been several major comets and meteors that have fallen upon the earth in history, and they can do monumental damage, and it doesn't take a very big one. So it would make absolute sense for this to be a gigantic comet. Now the interesting thing is that it fell upon the third of the rivers and upon the springs of the waters. How would that happen? How would it affect the water? How would that comet affect the water? Make it bitter? Yeah. What would be necessary to make it bitter, do you think? Sulfur? Yeah, could be. Could be sulfur. What I was thinking is, we know that some of these comets, people who've attempted to science it up, and I don't know how exactly they do it, but there's the belief that a lot of these comets are carrying a lot of dense metals in them. Well, once you get into the really dense metals, you're looking at radioactive metals. Tiny, tiny, tiny amounts of radioactive material, like we talked about with Chernobyl, tiny amounts of radioactive material can affect enormous sizes of the population. So a decent-sized meteor, when it hits the Earth and it explodes, if that thing's carrying polonium or some of the extremely deadly radioactive elements, and that gets scattered into the water supply, I mean, imagine how much damage that could do. You talk about a third of the rivers. She's fine. You see a major comet hits. Around Poland. And all of Europe is affected, all of Russia is affected, all of Eastern Europe is affected, Scandinavia is affected. That's a big part of the earth. That's a large part, So it is not out of, and then you've got, what do you got? You've got that problem of nuclear drift, right? So when the wind moves this dust that could have radioactive material, that was the huge worry with not only Chernobyl, but Fukushima, the Fukushima reactor in Japan, and then Three Mile Island in New Jersey. When Three Mile Island went up, they're like, oh, crap, which way is the wind blowing? Because if the wind blows back towards the coast, then a lot of that radioactive material could have gotten into mainland, more of the mainland United States, rather than blowing out into the ocean. So that's always the concern, is the nuclear fallout. Which way is it going to go? That's an assumption that I'm making. But it says that the name of the star is Wormwood. And we've already seen in the Old Testament that Wormwood is, when the word is used, is a word that means something, it makes things bitter. And a third of the waters became into wormwood, and many of the men died out of the waters that were embittered. Okay, now, where have we seen something bitter being thrown into water before? Elijah did the opposite. There was death in the pot because they picked those herbs, and he threw the bread in it. And they're like, oh, master, there's death in the pot. The bitter water that brings a curse, right? Because if she's, the priest, if a man suspects his wife, then he is to bring the wife, and they take some water, and they scrape up some dirt off the floor of the temple, and they kind of dust it in, and then they write the words of the law on there, on ink on some kind of parchment, and then they rinse the ink off in, so, you know, her teeth are going to be black for a little bit, you know, so, and she's going to, and then he says, you know, if you drink this water and you are innocent, you know, nothing's going to happen to you. But if you are guilty, if you have strayed, if you have been unfaithful, may your abdomen swell and your thighs shrivel up, and may you die childless, and it's awful. And then she drinks the water, and, you know, and then we see, you know, then it's kind of a wait and see thing. So definitely that is a use of bitter water in the Old Testament. So there's one other usage where we see bitterness in kind of a neat way. But I'm thinking specifically, there was something that was bitter that was thrown into water. Old Testament. Ooh, let's play this game. Yes, Old Testament. First five books. It wasn't with the plagues. It was shortly after, though. No, not the gold. Oh, yeah, crap. That's a good one, yeah. So they ground up the idol and they had to drink it. So that's a good one. I wasn't thinking about these. You guys are coming up with great examples. There was one specific example, though, where there was wood that was thrown into the water. What's that? Nope, not the accent. That, man, good job. You guys really know your Bible. You just don't know this one thing I'm asking you to remember. You guys know everything else in the Bible. You just don't know this one thing I'm trying to get. I'll just give it away because this will get boring fast. But the waters of Mara and Meribah. Remember, Mara is Hebrew for bitter. So if you meet a girl named Mary, it's like, hey, you know, bitter, how you doing? So they probably don't like that. But Mara means bitterness. And what happened? The people came to the water and it was bitter and they couldn't drink it. And so God told him, hey, take that stick and throw it into the water. And he throws the stick into the water. And what happens? The water becomes sweet. Now the reverse happens. So remember, what we see in Revelation, there are two things we see in Revelation. And we mentioned this, I've mentioned this a couple times now, but it's really important to remember. Two things happen. Either we see the exact pattern that we see in the Old Testament is repeated, or we see it reversed ironically. So here it's reversed ironically. In the Old Testament, people are coming out of where? Egypt, where the plagues have struck. They're just out of the plagues. So the people have escaped the plagues, and God takes bitter water and makes it sweet. Here, the people cannot escape the plagues, and they're warned that there are more plagues. Literally, that's the word, is plague. The plagues are coming. They can't escape them, and God takes sweet water and makes it bitter. So what we see, what is God saying? So let's take, we're right here, we're down at ground level. Now I want you guys to put on your theologian hats. So it's going to be a really dorky looking hat. Nobody's going to like you, but you know that's what you got to do if you want to be a theologian. You got to accept that. So we're down here right on the text of the page. Let's take a big step back and say, okay, what's the overall message? Why is God, our biblical theology, why is God reversing what he did for the Israelites that was good? Why is he reversing that to the people on the earth now? There are several correct answers. There's not just one right answer. Idolatry? Yes. Absolutely. He's doing it because of their idolatry. But what is God communicating about them? I'm not asking this question very correctly, very, very cleanly. That they're heathens, yes. Even more specifically, because this goes, what I'm asking you goes right to the heart of the theology of the Old Testament and the theology of the book of Revelation. Yeah, absolutely. I'm not saying you're wrong. You're absolutely right. I'm just thinking in a couple different words because I've got the point that I want to make. But what you said is, believers, we are grafted in. We are the wild olive shoots that, contrary to nature, are grafted into the cultivated olive tree. And what God is doing is the opposite here. He's cutting out these branches. He's cutting people out. And so, absolutely, that is 100% correct. That is right in line with what I'm thinking. I'm looking for specific words because of the way I teach, and it's kind of annoying of me, but whatever. Okay, so excellent point. I 100% agree. I think you guys are like right on track with where I'm going. What you said is, for those listening at home, is God, when he's dealing with Pharaoh, he's saying, you need to stop offending my people, and God wants to care for his people. The emphasis there is my people. God does things in the Old Testament with his people that are being reversed here against the people that are still on the earth. So what's the implication from that? If what God does for his people is the exact opposite for what he's doing for you, what would that imply? What's that? No, my thinking is they're not his people. I mean, you're probably thinking, oh gosh, Luke, like that's your fancy theologian hat. But it is, right? Like the Bible is really hard sometimes, but most of the time it's pretty simple. Like if what he's doing is, if everything God is doing in the Exodus is, if the refrain in the Exodus is, go and tell Pharaoh, let my people go so that they may worship me in the desert. Let my people go so that they may worship me in the desert. Let my people go so they may worship me in the desert. And Pharaoh says, no, 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 no. And the result of them not letting the Israelites go, not letting his people go to worship him in the desert, is that God plagues the Egyptians until he destroys them. What that seems to be saying is God will work miracles and strike plagues against the enemies of his people. But what that implies then is the people who are being punished with the plagues, the people who are having God's actions reversed against them, they're not his people. And why aren't they his people? Because they've rejected him. They've taken the mark of the beast. They've sided against him. They've said, they've cried out and prayed to the mountains, fall on us and hide us from the face of the Lamb. Hide us from the wrath of the Lamb. You know, they are actively opposed to him. And what Revelation is about, and this is my thinking, but what Revelation is about is when we look at chapter 21, and he says, behold, the tent of God is with men, and he will tent with them, and they will be his people, and he will be God with them. Over and over and over, what is God's promise to the Israelites? I will be your God, and you will be my people. You will be my people, I will be your God. I will live with you. I will be with you to be your God, and you will be my people. Over and over and over. And here in Revelation 21, it's fulfilled. God is making the world ready so that he can be on earth with his people, and his people will be there so that he can be their God, and they will be his people. And what we see here is this is what God is doing to those who are not his people. Those who reject him, those who are his enemies. When his people are in the desert and they're thirsty, what does he do? They come to bitter water and he says, you're going to throw this wood into the water and it's going to become sweet. Now he takes sweet water and they throw bitter wood, wormwood, into the water and it becomes bitter and it kills them. And so we see this ironic reversal. John is a king of irony. Like if you've never read John looking for irony, start, like, next time you read through John, which should be soon, read John's material. It is full of irony. I think John was snickering to himself a lot as he was writing his material because it is full of dramatic irony. But we see that the waters became embittered. I feel like we've given a pretty good answer of how that could happen. It very easily, a meteor hitting the earth could easily do all the things that we're seeing here. And then we see verse 12, and the fourth angel trumpeted, and a third of the sun, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars were plagued. Notice the emphasis on that word, plagued. Now, I mentioned last week that the Greek word plague can mean a strike, or it can also mean plague, kind of in the sense that we use it. But really, the word means for something to be struck, for something to be hit. But I want to translate it plague because it's deliberate. John wants us to think of the Old Testament plagues. He wants us to think of the plagues of Egypt. And so we see that the third of the moon and the sun are struck, and there was extra darkness during the day and the night. And I'm not going to add a whole lot of commentary personally on this because, this is straight out of the Exodus. I'm not saying there's nothing more to say, but when you read your commentaries, so you'll read a commentary on Revelation that's about, you know, this thick, and you'll get to the seven trumpets, and normally there's like a page and a half dedicated to all seven of them, right? So like, especially this one, people don't say much about it because it's like, what do you have to say? If you understand the Exodus, you understand what's going on here, and I don't know how God does it. Again, it would be very possible if there were a gigantic meteor that hit the earth and it sent toxic radioactive material into the water, it could also very easily create a gigantic cloud. You guys are all old enough to remember. You remember when people used to talk about nuclear winter? You guys remember what nuclear winter is? You guys remember that term? They used to talk about it? Nuclear winter, the theory of nuclear winter is if there was a major nuclear conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union, that it would put so much dust and so much Okay, you got it. Remember now? Yeah, so it would put so much material into the air that would block the sun, and the Earth's temperature would drop significantly because there just not enough sunlight would be able to penetrate through the dust clouds. Could very easily be this. It could be God doing something different, but I don't think that we need anything more miraculous. Not that God can't do miracles, but we don't need anything more miraculous than the result of a gigantic comet, if that's what happens. You know, we've also had what looks like a gigantic volcanic explosion that's happened. Oh, you were going to say that? Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. No, that's awesome. Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, too, because it doesn't say how long this endures. It doesn't say that this continues throughout the entire tribulation. It might, and God can do it. I'm not questioning God's ability to do it. I'm simply saying that this could be something that only lasts a short time, that's a reminder to people. Hey, remember what happened to Egypt? Like Connie pointed out, the woes. Like, the woes are there. Like, to warn people who have an ear to hear. Those who have an ear to hear, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. If you're seeing these things being fulfilled and you're not on the right side, get on the right side, because it didn't work out too good for the Egyptians, right? Okay, so we see that. And then we get to verse 13. And I saw and I heard one eagle flying in mid-heaven, saying in a great voice, "Woe, woe, woe to the ones dwelling upon the earth because of the remaining plagues from the trumpets of the angels concerning the trumpeting that's about to happen." Okay, so I kind of cleaned up my English there to make it a little easier to follow. Why an eagle? Anybody else wonder that? Like, why an eagle? Yours says angel. What translation do you have? King James says angel. You have New King James or Old King James? Old King James? Deanne, what do you have? Because you use KJV, right? Yours says angel as well? Okay. What do you have? Amplified? Eagle? Anybody else have a different translation? So what's right? Okay, that is a really good question. What is right? So what we have is a really interesting issue here. So I don't know how familiar you guys are, so I will give a super duper fast crash course. I know I've talked about this before. If you've heard me talk about this many times, just go to sleep. I'll wake you up in a second. So the Old Testament, the New Testament, there's one standard version of the Old Testament that everybody uses when they translate. It's called the Masoretic Text. The Masoretic Text is this text that's been handed down for a very long time. There are problems with it. We know that there have been errors, and that's okay. Nobody's concerned about them. Everybody says we know there are errors. Even the Jews who were copying it, they continued to copy it knowing that there were some errors. Some of them were deliberate because they didn't want to blaspheme. Some of them were accidental, but we know where they are. Okay, so they're copying errors. No reasonable person doubts that. We use the Masoretic text rather than using what's called an eclectic text. So there are two ways to handle a translation, or there are two ways to handle putting this together. What I have right here is the Nestle Aland 28. Nestle Aland was a group of scholars, Kurt and Barbara Aland, and I forget what Nestle's name, and a couple other really top-notch Greek scholars, looked at as many Greek manuscripts as they could, and they tried their very hardest to figure out what was the original text. Now, that's one way. That's called an eclectic text. The other way is to use what's called a single text. And a single text version would be, okay, I have got Codex Sinaiticus, or Codex Vaticanus, and I'm just going to use that codex. I'm just going to use that copy, and that's going to be what I'm going to go with, right? Then there's one other version, which is kind of in between both of them, which is called the majority text idea. And the idea of the majority text is whatever most of them say, that's what I'm going to go with. Whether it makes sense or not, whatever most of them say, that's what I'm going to go with, right? So the King James Version, when it was originally translated, was for the most part used the version of the Greek New Testament written by Catholic scholar Desiderius Erasmus, the great Dutch humanist. And so Erasmus, this Catholic priest, he's working on it. He comes up with this version of the Greek New Testament, and he used, like, I think 7 or 8 manuscripts that he had handy when he was doing his eclectic text. And then the King James had more to work with, but they used that as their basis. Well, later, as more manuscripts have become available, we come up with what are called eclectic texts. Now, the interesting thing is, scholarship on eagle versus angel has gone back and forth. There are people who say, well, you know, the better manuscripts have angel. But other people are like, yeah, but eagle seems to make more sense here. So whichever way you go, okay, so that was a tiny crash course in text criticism. If you want to talk about text criticism, I'm happy to talk about that all day long with you. But for sake of time, sometimes when you have a reading, you go with the best manuscript because that's the best evidence you have. Sometimes you have to do, but sometimes the best manuscript has a reading that makes no sense at all, right? So you have to kind of weigh a lot of options. There are a lot of rules to text criticism, and they're changing all the time. But you got two options. You got angel or eagle. You've got eitos in Greek for eagle, and you got angelos in Greek for angel. They don't really look all that alike. But if it's angel, why would it be angel? Let me ask that. Yeah, go ahead. Because there is messengers, right? And what are we seeing throughout all of these trumpets? Go ahead. Eagles don't talk in English. That's true. They don't talk in Greek either, as far as I'm aware. But yes, you're right. If it were angels, this is perfectly in line with what we're seeing the rest of the material of the seven trumpets. We see angels, and we talked about that, what was it, 2 or 3 weeks ago, when we talked about how dense the angels are kind of packed into here. I know we talked about that. So it would make sense, it would fit, and we see these angels doing things. Here's the thing. Angels flying, okay, like they fly. We've actually seen in Revelation, we've seen angels fly. The term flying in midair, in mid-heaven, that's a little bit different. That would be something new. You know, we wouldn't expect that from an angel, but possible. Okay, and then he's talking. Cool, okay. What's the good argument for it being an eagle? Well, some of you guys are rolling your eyes because you're like, there clearly isn't a good one. Okay, but there are some good arguments for it being an eagle, right? One of the reasons why is one, it does seem better manuscripts have that, but there seems to be better attestation of eagle, which is why a lot of modern eclectic tests like Nestle Aland and United Bible Studies continue to use eagle. That's why most modern English translations have eagle, because they think it makes more sense with where it is. There are different rules. We can talk about that later if you're interested, but there are rules about it. But what we see is this eagle, and he's talking. Now, if the eagle is talking, we've only seen a couple places in the Bible where animals talk. Balaam's ass, and honestly, there's like one other place. I can only think of one other place where we see an animal talking. For sake of time, I'll just say it. The snake in the garden. And what did the snake in the garden say? Did God really say? So this slithering creature casts doubt on what God would do, on what God has said. Here, this soaring creature, this thing that's the picture of divinity, is now saying what God will do. He's a messenger of God. And so we see some ironic reversal. So that would be really fascinating if it's an eagle. There's also another reason why eagles make sense here. What do we see over and over in predictions about the end times? The birds are going to eat people. We'll see later when we get to the later chapters of Revelation. There's going to be an invitation. God is actually going to make an invitation and say, and again, it's kind of gruesome, but the wedding supper of the Lamb has just happened. So God says, hey, we just had a big old supper. Let's invite the birds to have supper on the kings, the princes, the centurions, the tribunes, all of these people that I'm going to kill. So now the birds get to have their supper. It's interesting you say it should be vultures, but throughout the Bible, eagles are described a lot more than vultures as being birds of prey. When warfare happens, when the eagles gather, right? So actually, and people who've been up to Alaska have said that eagles are like the vultures of Alaska in places, because they do, they're carrion birds. I mean, most animals, lions steal food from jackals a lot more than they do some hunting, you know, sometimes. So animals like that, the eagles will gather where there's war. In fact, I think that's even a proverb, you know, where the eagles gather. And so eagle, angel, take your pick. There are good arguments. There are good explanations either way. If it's an angel, it's right in line with what we've seen. No special significance to it. If it's an eagle, It means this is a warning of death, because here is this animal, an animal speaking, which is telling you that judgment is coming, and it's the kind of animal that eats you when you're dead. Things that we see, there are remaining plagues coming. These plagues, again, the word plague reminds us of what happened in Egypt. All of that should be in line. Does anybody have any final thoughts, questions, or concerns? The word is literally mid-heaven. It's mezo-uranamati, like Uranus is heaven. It's middle heaven. What on earth is middle heaven? I don't know. I think modern translations go with mid-air. Mid-heaven, I don't know what that is. Great question. So, sorry. I wish I had an answer. That's one of those things that the commentaries don't comment on, and you always know that it's a really good question if the commentaries don't comment on it, because they're like, well, maybe if I don't say anything, nobody will ask me, you know, so they can try to get by that way. But you can ask. Work on it. I honestly don't know that there's another place that word is used in the Bible. I'm pretty sure it's what's called a hapax legomenon, which means a word only used once. Doesn't matter. I think it's only used one time in the Bible. I think. I could be wrong, but I think. And so, what does it mean? Not only do I not know, but there's no Old Testament or New Testament passages I can look at to try to even get a guess at what it could mean. Other questions, comments, concerns? Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. Paul does talk about the third heaven, and it seems like there have been, throughout history, and I agree with you, I think that probably Paul and John and the other apostles probably believed in a three-heaven system. And so that would be, like he said, there'd be the planetary atmosphere and then what we would call space and then something beyond space. We know space is finite. It can't be infinite, right? We know space is finite. So here's the question, and just try to wrap this around your head. What is on the other end of space? It can't be more space, otherwise it would be space. Do you hit a wall at the end of space? This is one of the questions that keeps people up at night, right? This is a great question for atheists who believe that, you know, who are Big Bang believers. You know, it's like, okay, so they say, well, you know, it was just the Big Bang. And it's like, okay, well, where did the matter come from for the Big Bang? Well, it was just there. It's like, nah, sorry. Like, nope, can't do that. You have to explain where the matter came from. Well, you know, there were, you know, positrons, and there was matter and antimatter. It's like, no, can't do that. Well, there was space. No, you can't do that. You can't even have space. Like, you can't just have nothing. You have to have nothing, nothing. And I cannot conceive of nothing, nothing, because I've spent my whole life in something. So good job. They're learning some Latin expressions, so they're quite proud. They earned McDonald's with that one. Ars longa vita brevis. That's right. Art is long, life is short. So we've got that. I forget the question. Oh, the mid-heaven. Yeah. So first heaven, second heaven, third heaven. And that could be it. I know that there were some. I believe that there were some other people who believed in seven heavens. But I think you're right. I believe that Paul and the apostles accepted a three heaven view, which honestly is probably what we would say we agree in. We believe in. There's our planetary atmosphere, space, and then beyond that, if it is spatial, which I believe it is, there's probably heaven. And then the question is, did they use mid-heaven to describe the second heaven, or did they only use, would they call it like deutero-heaven, like second heaven? I will, shoot me a text and remind me, and I will spend some time within the next week digging into that, because that's an area that I know there's been a lot of scholarship on, and I really don't know anything about other than you probably know more about it than I do, but I'll use my resources and maybe ask some people and say, hey, like, what do we know about this? And maybe some people say, hey, we don't really know anything. So that's why we don't put it in the commentaries. Any other questions or comments before we close up? All right. Well, thank you guys very much. I had a lot of fun, as always. Next week, we will, I believe, get through, my goal is chapter 9 and probably, we might get through all of chapter 9 next week. It's gonna be close, but we'll probably shoot for all of chapter 9 next week.